Starting with what has happened in the United States attacking Donald Trump. How did you find it? What's your take?
Oh, it's not really surprising given the culture in the United States and so on. The problem is probably the interpretation of that. I'm not convinced that we have witnessed some kind of conspiracy thing also. I have the feeling it's just a feeling. Obviously, the case needs to be investigated, and that will give the truth about it. But my feeling is that this is a very much individual initiative of someone who wanted to get rid of Trump. But here lies the problem. First of all, it's the fifth type of assassination or attempt of assassination of this kind in the last couple of months. We have seen Prime Minister Fico in Slovakia. Viktor Orban has apparently also been targeted by some attempts. These were foiled, but still there were some attempts. There were also some attempts against Erdogan in Turkey. And apparently, that was also revealed a couple of days ago. There were some assassination attempts in Russia against Vladimir Putin, meaning that we are in a kind of atmosphere and mood that allows individuals to think about physical elimination of people they don't like. And I relate that to the mood which we see in the media, especially in Europe, where those guys who are not, let's say, mainstream, or they don't belong to the mainstream thinking, Fico, Orban, Erdogan, and so on and so forth, these guys are ruthlessly demonized by the media. And we compare them to Hitler. We compare them to people who needs to be eliminated. And when we talk about Trump, even a senator used the expression that he has to be eliminated. So, we have this kind of rhetoric that we have guys that we don't want. They are bad. They are bad for society. They are bad for economy. They are bad for everything. Basically, they are the evil, and they need to be eliminated, physically eliminated. And this is probably the tip of the iceberg, but to my opinion, it reflects the way people see politics today. And we have mentioned on your channel the European election and the election in France and so on. And we see that basically what motivates the choice of the voters is in fact the hate or rejection of politicians. It's not motivated by comparing programs or project or what they want to do and trying to identify what is best for the country, what is best for me, and things like that. It's not that. It's merely I hate this guy, and that's it. And when I say I hate this guy, it's not I don't vote for someone because I like him, but the vote is by default. That means the thinking is, who do I want to eliminate? And then the guy who gets elected is in fact the guy who was not eliminated. It's not a preference, it's the result of a rejection. And that was absolutely clear in the vote in the UK, for instance. Well, Labour and Keir Starmer was elected with the lowest score since the 1918 or 1935. I don't remember exactly. But in any case, the Labour had never had such a low score. But the problem is that the Tories were even more hated than the Labour. So that's the reason why the Labour candidate was eventually elected. So we are in this kind of politics where nobody knows exactly where we are heading to. They just know that they don't want such or such guy. And this is a very strange evolution that we have seen in whole Europe. That was exactly the same, by the way, in the French election. They don't, in the legislative election that happened a few weeks ago in France, they didn't choose the best one or the one that reflects the most the needs of the country. No, they just, in fact, expressed their rejection of Macron and his party. That's all. And then they had to choose between two evils, and some chose the right one, a right-wing one, some others chose the left-wing one. But the essence of the vote was here again rejection and not preference. And that's a little bit what we are witnessing in this case with Trump, in fact. We tend to reject people that we don't like. We don't even know exactly why we don't like him. And that was very much reflected also in the first mandate of Trump. People were against him, but nobody knows exactly why. Was it because he wanted to prevent immigration and he wanted to build his wall? But in reality, the wall was started by Obama, and I think even by Bush. So that means that it was not Trump's idea. It was an idea that came before, and Trump just wanted to proceed with the project. But nevertheless, for most people in the US and even in Europe, and probably more especially in Europe, people tend to think that this wall project was a Trump's project. So we tried to focus on a few issues, and that was it. Nobody questioned, in fact, his policy for making US great again and things like that. I never saw in Europe a real study or report on what Trump wanted to do. Even when he started to be more, let's say, I don't find the word, but he tried to push or to press NATO partners, I mean the European partners of NATO, to fund to fund more to spend more on defense expenditure. And this was considered as, again, as a Trump idea, and that was the idea of Trump wanted to drop the NATO and so on and so forth. In reality, the whole discussion about the European contribution to NATO is a very old one. This was known already during the Cold War as the project of burden sharing. And since the 70s, the US felt that they were in fact supporting most of the burden, the financial burden of NATO, and the European didn't pay the fair share for the protection of Europe. And in fact, Trump just resurrected thinking that was already around since about 40 years. So nothing new in that. But however, Trump was considered as the one who wanted to eliminate NATO, or to US to withdraw from NATO. We heard everything, which was totally pointless and even wrong. So we don't know exactly why we don't like him. But, and even you had all these accusation against him that he tried to make special deals with Russia, and he had a preference for Putin, and he wanted to have privileged relation with Russia and Putin. In fact, in one of my books, I think it's the first book I wrote about the crisis in Ukraine. It was published in March 2022. I made a summary of all the measures that were taken by the Trump administration against Russia. And in fact, you could see that no administration before Trump had taken so many measures against Russia. So the idea that Trump, Trump is a pro-Putin and he's a servant of Putin, and so, is pointless. So again, we have we criticize Trump, and I personally am not a partisan of Trump, but at the same time, nobody knows exactly why they don't like him. In fact, Trump is probably the only president in the recent history who didn't start a new war, who tried to stop wars. Even Obama, who got a Nobel Prize, started two or three wars, and had, in fact, I think even Obama is the only president in the recent history who had the United States at war from the first day of its mandate to the very last day of its mandate. So, that means that our understanding of those politicians is totally irrational. And that reflects very much in the case of Trump. And in addition to that, we have, it's obvious in the US, but we have a similar problem in other countries in Europe, that the current leaders are considered by the average citizen as totally incompetent. They may prefer this guy to the to another one. That might be the case, but at the same time, they recognize that all leaders are incompetent, and this is the problem we have in especially in the United States. We are, I mean, the U.S. citizen is probably facing a very hard choice between two evils, continuing with Biden, who his intellectual abilities are obviously decreasing, and Donald Trump, who is probably, let's say, is a totally unpredictable, and I think that's this. That for, to me, it's the this main drawback with Trump. He has no real program. He is a very instinctive person. He reacts. He's a businessman. He reacts to the market, but there is no defined line, and that's a reason. By the way, you may remember that a few months ago, Vladimir Putin was asked who he would prefer, whether he would prefer Vladimir Putin or he would prefer Joe Biden or Donald Trump. And he said, I would prefer Joe Biden. It might be that this was kind of a maneuver in order to discredit Joe Biden. I don't exclude that. But at the same time, this kind of answer might be understandable from a Russian perspective, because Biden is predictable. And the worst, when you are at war or when you are at odds with someone, the most difficult is when your adversary is unpredictable. If he reacts inadvertently to a situation and in a way that you don't expect. Joe Biden is totally predictable in that sense. And from an adversary point of view, I would prefer to have such an enemy against me, even if Biden is certainly more aggressive towards Russia than Trump would be versus Russia, because Trump is a pragmatic person. And probably he would try to solve the problem, not because he likes Russia, but because he thinks it's not in the interest of the United States to proceed in a conflict where you You put a bunch of money without receiving any return on that money. And so it's a mere pragmatic approach to problems. But at the same time, this kind of approach is a double-edged sword. That means it may work in favor of Russia, or it may work against again. The only thing we are certain with Donald Trump is that he hates China. That's for sure. In that sense, he is a real Republican, but for a good reason. I mean, a good reason. For a reason that we can explain, because he wants to make US great again. And he realizes that with such a competitor as China, the US will not make it. So they need to, let's say, discard or discredit or eliminate, or you can use the word you want, this competitor, and or to keep him down in order to have this advantage, the advantage the US had up to the early 2000s. And that's probably the reason why, especially Republicans who tend to focus on domestic politics and the development and industrial and development within the United States. That's probably the reason why they really hate China, because China is the most serious competitor, definitely. So that's the predictable side. But for the rest, Trump is totally unpredictable. The result is that since we don't know this person, they have complex reaction to complex problems. The idea that you solve the problem by killing someone is almost a natural choice, and that becomes even a more natural choice when you see the disarray that you're observing within the Democrat Party in the US, for instance. The same as you have in other part of Europe, by the way. Nobody knows exactly. I mean, you could feel it in France just before the legislative election, when it was this, I mean, polls and all that shows that the right-wing party could emerge from this legislative election. At the end, it was not really the case, but nevertheless, there was this fear that the right wing may emerge. You have the same fear in Germany, for instance, and you have this same kind of, not fear, but more concern now in the UK with the party of Nigel Farage, for instance. So we see that there is a concern that somebody more extreme may come to the power, and that disturbs the thinking in the main party, because again, most of the political leaders in Europe do not have really ideas, or have not the intellectual capabilities to bring tangible solutions to current problems. As a result, they feel threatened by right-wing party or more extreme parties. And in such a situation, when you feel threatened from different sides, then you may come to extreme solutions. And I'm not suggesting that the assassination attempt against Fico, Orban, or Trump are conspiracies. But the disarray that is obvious in the political establishment might also may affect also individuals who feel concerned by the domestic politics, and therefore they might be tempted to act by themselves instead of waiting for any party to act. They decide to act. That's my feeling. Again, for all these assassination attempts in all these countries. There are inquiries going on, and the ultimate truth will come from that. But in the background of this, my feeling is that this reflects very much the mood that we are witnessing, especially in Europe, but we feel it also in the United States, about these the lack of constructive, solid, intelligent, and effective leadership. We see leadership that are totally unable to resolve the question. And it's very, very obvious in Europe when the problem, not all the problems, but many problems, in fact, are generated by the European Union themselves. And that would require either that some countries get out of the European Union, or that the European Union, the rules and the procedures within European Union should be adapted in order to solve, to allow for solving problems of individual countries. Problem is that the European Union is probably too rigid to adjust itself and to adapt to such a moving environment. As a result, if you react based on ideology, and if your ideology is the European one, some say Europeist or something like that ideology, then you will not find the solution. Everything you will do will just increase the problem. And that's exactly what we're witnessing in France, for instance. This is absolutely obvious. We see that a little bit, probably a little bit less, but the same in Belgium. And you see that in Germany, obviously. So there is here a real concern of the adaptability of the political leadership to the context, and not just the market as such, but also the institutional context. And again, there is absolutely no vision or no incentive to make European Union as an example. There might be others, but the European Union is a good example. But there is absolutely no incentive to make European Union more adjustable to the current situation. So we are in a kind of way, a dead end somehow in the political thinking. And that dead end may lead in some individuals to think that, okay, the we don't want to have the Trump, Hitler Trump, or Hitler Putin, or Hitler Fizzo, or Hitler Orban, you know, because everything is reduced to kind of perception that you are either good or Hitler. So this is, and therefore, all alternative thinking should be right away eliminated, and that's my first impression of that assassination attempt. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if I look at the positive side of it, if I could say that, some have other made comments, but for me, as European, and having been, having lived several years in the United States, I noticed that the U.S. mentality is somewhat very different from the mentality in Europe. In the United States, the value of hardworking people, the value of people able to not just resist, but to fight against to find solutions. Even if you fail, or if you are threatened by failure, the fact that you try to react, you don't just give up, but you try to react and to try to find a solution is in the United States a virtue, which may not be the case in Europe. In Europe, if you are, for instance, you are an entrepreneur and you fail and your company goes bankrupt, then you are dead. Nobody will trust you anymore. In US, if you are bankrupt, but then you restart a new business, you try to move ahead and not just rest on that failure, but you try to move ahead, try to do something new, try to restart and try to find a success. This behavior is considered as a virtue in the United States. As a result, when you got fired at, and you react exactly as did Donald Trump, by the way, with the fist and a kind of revolutionary type of reaction, and you stand firm and you say, I will continue to fight. That's the kind of behavior, regardless of the political party, that's the kind of behavior that the U.S. citizen will value very high. And the fact that you don't give up. There is a motto which is used by a company that makes sport goods, sporting goods. I don't want to mention the name here, but the motto is just do it, you know. And that's exactly what the Americans value, this idea of try it, give it a try. The United States, after all, is nicknamed the land of opportunity. And that reflects exactly this kind of mentality where you don't give up, you try to do your best, and you struggle even if you have a strong adversaries, if you are a strong adverse situation, then you with the will, the willingness to do something, then you can move ahead. And in my view, what this assassination attempt brought to the surface was exactly this kind of behavior that the average US citizen appreciates and values most, and therefore I would not be surprised if Donald Trump would in fact just won the presidential election during the weekend, just because of that, because that's exactly what we expect from a president, a guy who doesn't give up, who moves forward, wants to solve situations and think like this, which in fact Joe Biden didn't do during the past years. Whether Donald Trump will use the right tools, will try to do it the right way, this is an open question. I have some question marks on this, but I'm not a U.S. citizen. I'm not voting in the U.S. I'm just trying to make a judgment based on my observation of the U.S. society, having lived within this society, trying to understand or how people will interpret these events and how they might, or this might influence their vote. So that's just my personal view as a European in the US. So this must be taken with all care. But many people have said that in fact this assassination in reality could boost the popularity of Donald Trump in the coming months. After all, we are just a few months away from the presidential election. So these are the two aspects that that's made me interested to this event. For the rest, again, I'm not speculating on who was behind this and whether or not the U.S. Secret Service did its job or not. These are technical matters. I've been myself, I've been trained in the protection of very important persons in dangerous environment. When I was in the British intelligence, I had the training in for this kind of situation in a counterinsurgency, counterterrorist situation. So I could see that there are some obviously some flaws in the planning and the execution of the protection of Donald Trump, but these are technical matters. We have also to say that we are always smarter after the event than before. It's always more easy to make the judgment afterwards than before. But nevertheless, obviously, the work was not done properly, not with the necessary attention. And probably what was missing is the, again, I'm speaking about from an intelligence point of view, but what is probably missing is the understanding of the general mood, what I explained before, this idea that it's kind of a polarized approach to politicians, that you are either very good or very bad, and if you are very bad, you need to be eliminated. And this we see that again in Europe also, this tendency to polarize the approach to politicians, to avoid dialogue between parties. They don't want that. That's obvious in Europe. Nobody wants to talk to a right-wing party, even if they are obviously strong and needs to be involved in some coalitions and so on. This applies to Germany or others. But the readiness to dialogue has disappeared, and this is rather new in Europe because, as I said before, even during the Cold War, even if the enemy was obviously communism and the communists and communist parties and so on, and you had many European communist parties that were funded by the Soviet Union. So the communists were obviously the enemy, let's put it that way. And but nevertheless, there were discussions, there are dialogue, they were invited in debates, and they were their point of view was also listened to. And nobody tried to assassinate this or that. And so we had a better understanding of the democratic dialogue, because at the end of the day, democracy is about dialogue. It doesn't mean that you have to accept everything, but at least you have to understand each other. And we are more and more in a political environment where we don't accept that others may think differently. Therefore, you are conspiracy theorist, you are right wing, you are pro Putin, you are, you know, we tend to qualify individuals with terrible names just in order to prevent any discussion, because you will not discuss to anyone who is pro-Putin, because Putin is the ultimate evil, and therefore why would you talk to someone who is in favor of Putin? And to be in favor of Putin, it just needs to be against the war. That's exactly the same thing you have about the Palestinian conflict. If you start talking about a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians, then automatically you're anti-Semitic. So, you know, there are a lot of people who are not anti-Semitic, and as a matter of fact, there are many Jews and probably even in the media world, or probably a majority, I mean, the alternative media, you have probably a majority of Jews who are struggling to convince people that a ceasefire is necessary. So these guys are certainly not anti-Semitic. But anyway, since we don't want a ceasefire with the Palestinians, since we want to continue war with the Palestinians, then anybody who is in favor of a ceasefire is de facto anti-Semitic. And that's very clear that it was again in France that was the left-wing party of Mr. Mélenchon is a party that was extremely vocal about the support to Palestinians and was very vocal for advocating a ceasefire. And immediately they were qualified as anti-Semitic, because being for the ceasefire means that you are in favor of the Hamas, and if you are in favor of the Hamas, you're automatically anti-Semitic. So this is the kind of thing. And that goes so far that a politician in France, that's in my book, by the way, that's something that was very strange, because Hamas is considered as Islamist movement. The Islamic State is an Islamist movement. The Islamic State in 2015 and 16 conducted some terrorist attack in France. Therefore, the Hamas was part of the terrorist attack. So, and one politician said the Hamas attacked France, which is factually totally wrong. I mean, the Hamas has clearly limited its action to the territory of Palestine, and it was absolutely consistent with this policy. The Hamas has never made any terrorist attack or any kind of attack outside of the territory of Palestine. But nevertheless, you have a politician that can say on the TV, well, the Hamas attacked France. So we are in this kind of, this demonization of the enemy goes so far that it totally distorts the perception of the reality. And therefore, in such an environment, in my view, and again coming back to the this assassination attempt of Trump, this idea or this observation that the political environment and even the society itself becomes more and more polarized seems not to have influenced let's say, the tactics or the preparation of the Secret Service. I think we are, and that's a little bit sad to say so, but we are in a more extreme environment as we had before. And therefore, the whole political environment is extremely dangerous, much more dangerous than it was 30 or 40 years ago, just before the radicalization and polarization of the extremes. So these are the some thoughts about this assassination attempt.
Don't you think that the governments, they're playing a very important role in radicalizing these societies? Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs says, Maria Zakharova said that this attempts on Putin, to kill Putin, was financed by the United States. And at the same time, we're hearing that Israel just killing individuals, not fighting the fight. You know, these type of activities in Ukraine, in Gaza, everywhere, see, it makes some sort of radicalization in the society, within the society, and we don't understand. It seems to me that whenever you kill the enemy, it doesn't matter. And that's why these people are feeling so convinced to do that.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. And when you say the governments, I would add the media, because they play a very important role in our perception of the political environment and the societal environment at large. So, and I fully agree with you that they bear a very, very high responsibility on that. And the problem is, again, we are back to what I said before. Because those politicians are unable to tackle the problems. They're intellectually not able to do it. As a result, their first reaction is to shut down any kind of opposition. And we see more and more censorship, for instance, that affects the social networks. You have the European Union that has a program starting now to make censor on all the social network platforms. I think there are now some discussions between Elon Musk and the European Union because of that. But that's an evolution we didn't have even during the Cold War. And it shows that there's an expression in German. This is the Konfliktfähigkeit. Konfliktfähigkeit, directly translated, it would mean the capacity or the capability of being in conflict. And the word is probably not the translation is probably not very good, but the Konfliktfähigkeit in German means that you are able to deal with a conflict, you are able to deal with a situation, an adverse situation. And in my view, this ability is disappearing. We are not able to deal with conflict situation. We have to shut down the opposition very quickly. We forbid the others to speak. There is no, for instance, I tried myself here in Belgium with tried to have contradictory debates about Ukraine. You cannot do that. Nobody wants to talk even about this. Is that because they don't feel like being able to come with arguments and to discuss seriously, factually the matter? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that you never have, even on the media, at least in Europe, you don't have contradictory debates about Ukraine. You don't. And the excuse is that if you would do that, that would give a platform to those guys who are in favor of Russia. But as a result, we hear only one side of the conflict. The average citizen, the guy who doesn't spend so much time in studying documents and studying the media and all that, this guy, in fact, receive only one side or one part of the information regarding the conflict. The same applies to the conflict in Palestine, by the way. You know, I have mentioned that, I think, on your channel, but when I start to write my book on this Al-Aqsa flood, I was surprised to see that in Israel itself, a lot of journalists try to understand what happened during the 7th of October, and even had a kind of a critical approach to the way the Israeli government reacted to the Palestinian attack. And they discovered that most of the casualties that happened during that day were in fact the product of the disarray and chaos within the Israeli armed forces. And there were very interesting studies and reports made in the Israeli media. But these reports were never translated or even reproduced in any country in Europe. They remained in Hebrew, on Hebrew channel and things like that. They were not translated. So that means that our picture, the picture we have of these conflicts, is extremely limited. We have only one side. We have the image of just one side and not the other. And the problem is there is a point where the reality comes to the surface. Regardless of what you do and what you try to do, there is a point where the narrative becomes challenged by the reality. And that's exactly what we are witnessing in Ukraine today, and even in Palestine. And we see that even recently, the Palestinian, Israeli spokesman of the IDF, he had to confess that Hamas cannot be beaten. So, but this is something that was even barely mentioned in the European media. And in Ukraine, you have exactly the same situation. As a result, we have the governments and the media tend, as you rightly said, to polarize the situation. And we don't want to listen to the other, because Hamas is a terrorist movement and Putin is a terrorist or Hitler. So you don't have to listen that part. And therefore, everything you do, regardless of what you do, is legitimate. Even if you use dirty means to solve the problem, this will be justified and legitimated by the fact that the enemy is considered as an absolute evil. And when you mentioned those assassination attempts, we could mention the different terrorist attack that that were conducted in Russia. I mean, we know that they came from Ukraine. We know it not just because the Russians said it, but because the Ukrainians themselves told us. So we know that they are conducting terrorist activities. But this kind of terrorism is accepted by Europe. It's completely accepted. We don't care if there are children killed in a terrorist attack or in a ruthless attack. I mean, even during before the February 2022, you had all these attacks against the Republic of Donetsk and Lugansk. And this was absolutely open. I mean, you had daily reports from the OSCE observers, and we knew that the Ukrainian government was in fact shooting at its own citizens, and eventually made 10,000 fatalities among its own citizens. So this is a well-known fact. But this was accepted by the West, by Western countries, because we don't like the Russians. So this is exactly, you have exactly the same thing in Syria, for instance, where in 2015, I mean, between 2012 and 2016 or 17, the West supported terrorist activities in Syria. They supported Islamist terrorist activities. And even today, you have those Islamists, now they have left the Islamic State, they joined other groups, so they just changed the name of the group, if you want, so they are not targeted by the West. And now they live quietly in the area of Idlib under the protection of Turkey, which is a NATO country. And remember that the two elimination that the U.S., I mean, the U.S. Special Forces eliminated the head of the Islamic State. These two elimination happened in this area, which is protected by Turkey. I mean, that means that the leadership of the Islamic State was taking refuge in an area protected by a NATO country. That's it. So meaning that we have a very differentiated view on what is terrorism. By the way, when we call for, as an example, Hamas as a terrorist group, in fact, if you look carefully, only 30 or 35 countries in the world design Hamas as a terrorist group, Western countries. But the rest of the world does not consider Hamas as a terrorist group, just as an example. The same for Hezbollah. And that's probably also explains why Just a few days ago, the Hezbollah was taken out of the list of terrorist organizations from the Arab League. Because they did that, they put the Hezbollah on that list on the pressure of the US and all that. And today people understand that, in fact, this list, this doesn't mean anything. And if you, regardless of how you designate a group, if you are able to talk to them, if you are able to solve the problem with them, then these guys, I mean, nobody is born to be a terrorist. Nobody wakes up in the morning with the idea of killing someone and things like this. I mean, there are probably some psychopaths, even in the West. But as a terrorist, I think it's a, it, people don't, nobody is terrorist by birth, okay? So they become terrorists because they find a rationale for that, because they find a reason for taking arms and fighting up to the last minute and to the last sacrifice. But it doesn't mean that we don't have to fight against terrorism, but we have to do it intelligently. And the first measure is probably not to create the conditions that will, let's say, favor the development of terrorism. So this is it sounds stupid, but apparently the West has not understood that. But coming back to that, to the question of when we define a group as terrorists, like the Hamas, then that the consequence of that is in fact just to close the door to negotiation. That's the only effect. There is no other effect than this. I mean, you can probably prosecute someone with a harsher legal context than otherwise. But in essence, the result of designating an organization as terrorist is that so you prevent negotiation. That's the only tangible and immediate result of designating an organization as terrorist. And when you see after the 7th of October last year, you had more and more countries in Europe. Switzerland, for instance, was a country that I don't know exactly the status now, what they have decided, but at least it was the discussion of designating Hamas as terrorists, which is in fact contradictory, because if you want to discuss with them, if you want to open negotiation, if you want to solve the problem, then we should avoid to treat them as terrorists, especially if it's an organization that has absolutely no activity in Europe whatsoever. For instance, if they are in your country, then of course you need to have legal tools and legal instruments to fight against them. Then probably it makes sense to designate a group which is in your country that you define it as terrorists. But there's no point defining a group that is far away, that operates far away from your country, to designate it as terrorists, because then you close every single opportunity to have a negotiation and to have a mediation work with those with this group. So, but this is part of the mentality today. You want to excommunicate people right away when you have a problem, rather than to engage in dialogue, discussion, or negotiation. And and so that's the culture. And I think that's probably when we go back to this assessment of the the work of the US Secret Service. I'm not in the US Secret Service, but I would assume that the first step in establishing a protection for any leader or very important person, your first step is to assess the environment itself. I mean, the danger, the threat level, which is inside the population, not just the threat at a very specific moment, but the threat in terms of how the population reacts to these the situation, the political situation at large, and how polarized is the population? What are the trends in the polarization and the radicalization of the population? And probably this was poorly assessed in the US, but the US is probably not worse than any other countries. When you see, for instance, in France, any type of demonstration you have in Paris ends up as a riot with they set cars on fire, they destroy properties, they attack and loot stores and things like that. Even if the demonstration was about something extremely benign. So we see that violence becomes more and more pregnant in the population, and I think that's the kind of situation. I mean, this kind of environment we should assess, or situation we should assess more precisely. We see the I'm sure I'm not in the planning group of political rallies and all that, but I assume that organizing a political rally today is very different from what we used to do probably 30 or 40 years ago, because the overall radicalization and polarization within the population is much higher today than it used to be before. And probably people are more convinced that they held the truth, or they hold the truth, and therefore they are entitled to go violent because they feel legitimate to use violence, which was probably not the case 30, 50 years ago, or less the case, because we had also violence in certain countries. But today it seems to be a standard operating procedure, if you want, to use violence. And even if you look at the French situation, for instance, you see that the protesters are violent, are more violent today, but also the police is more violent and use methods that are extremely dangerous. And they if you look at all the demonstrations that happened to be in the 2019 at the beginning of the presidential mandate of Emmanuel Macron, the so-called yellow vest movement, you had 11 deaths. You know, that's much more. By the way, that's much more than the repression of demonstration in Russia at the time where you had demonstration about Alexei Navalny. And in fact, there were no dead death in if I remember well, I might be wrong, but I think there was no death in that. And I'm not even talking about the very heavy injuries that demonstrators in France suffered, while in the Russia, for instance, apparently the police is able to master a situation with less lethal and less harmful methods and tools. So it's we are in an environment where violence becomes widespread, not just within the society, but also in the government themselves. So yes, the governments tend to, in fact, generate the violence they try to fight afterwards. So it's kind of the snake bites its tail. So this is a little bit the situation. But the media are probably not, they are also to blame, because again, the situation, everything you see, and again, I'm talking from a European perspective and looking at what I see in the French-speaking media, and I compare with the English-speaking media. For instance, the French-speaking media, if you talk about Ukraine or Palestine, You see that the reports about the situation is much more radical in the media. And the media does not hesitate to condemn and to judge individuals and to use very harsh words against those who are not in the mainstream, if you want. And that, in my view, affects also the perception of the conflict, and not just the conflict, but also affect the perception of the actors. And that goes very far. I mean, in France, you had, after the intervention, the Russian intervention in Ukraine, you had restaurants in France who were attacked by individuals because they had, there is a dish, by the way, it's not even a French dish, it's a Canadian dish, which is called a poutine. And those restaurants used to have on their menu poutine. And they were attacked with Molotov cocktails and things like this, with stone and destroyed, just because they proposed this dish, which has nothing to do with Russia. It's a mere Canadian, French Canadian specialty. So that shows how stupid are people, first of all, but it shows also how polarized is population, and they do not hesitate to even attack individuals who may have a link with Russia. And you know, I am still puzzled by this initiative of the National Gallery in London. And I think it's a National Gallery. They had a painting of the famous painter Degas from the end of the 19th century, if I'm not wrong. And this painting had the title Russian Ballerinas. And so they changed the name to Ukrainian Ballerinas. So it just shows how institutions, instead of keeping art, sport, or other activities that have nothing to do with politics, instead of keeping those activities neutral, and if you talk about a museum, in my view, should be a platform for dialogue, for discussion, for encounter, to exchange with anybody, regardless of if it's blue, red, green, yellow, no matter who is. This is a place where you exchange ideas, feeling, emotions, whatever. But now, even in such a situation, you just polarize it. You politicize something that doesn't need to be politicized. And a painting that traced back the 19th century becomes suddenly dragged into the conflict of the 21st century. The same thing, by the way, with the Olympic Games. When you exclude Russian athletes, I find that's totally stupid. And remember that the Olympic Games in the ancient times, the Greeks, when they invented the Olympics game, it was a period of peace. And that was the opportunity for all the factions and parties and republics that were in the that were in Greece at that time, to compete, not just to confront, but to compete. And therefore, we used to have this kind, this Olympic peace, where regardless of the situation, you just stopped war and you had the sports event. But today, the decision of the Olympic Committee to exclude Russian athletes It's exactly, I have exactly the same kind of thinking that you may have with the museum before. I mean, the Olympic Games should be the field where you compete without any politics, without consideration whether you are Ukrainian, Russian, French, Swiss, whatever. You just compete and this is it. And you compete, it's a matter of preparation. It's also a matter of exchanging with others. It's probably a place where you can shake hands with each other. So the first step towards peace. But no, we decided to politicize this, and we decided that this is also part of the conflict. And so we see that we are not able to make the distinction between the war that is going on in Ukraine and between Ukraine and Russia and other activities that should help to bring us to dialogue, to peace, to mutual understanding, and things like this. Our government do exactly the opposite. They somehow promote this antagonism within the society. They promote this kind of hate between each other. In fact, they made absolutely no effort to calm things down. And you have even in some countries, for instance, in France, they decided to block or to shut down bank accounts of anybody who has a name which name sounds Russian. Sounds Russian. So I'm not even talking about Russians having a bank account in France, but this bank account of people whose name sounds Russian. So it's just the promotion of hate, nothing else. There's absolutely no sense. And I know some individuals in France who have been suddenly the bank account is just blocked, period. You can't receive money, you can't, so yeah. It's just amazing how we try to import conflict in our societies and to bring the conflict down to every citizen. But the reason for that is probably because we are not so sure that we are on the right side. That's the reason. If we were so sure that we were on the right side, we would not need to have this kind of instruments or kind of coercion or coercion of citizens. I mean, during the Cold War, we didn't need that. We didn't need that. We didn't need to have a censorship in Europe. I mean, in any a paper stand in France or in Switzerland, you could buy the Pravda, which is the official a paper of the Communist Party in Soviet Union. But you could buy this. There's mere propaganda. Pravda was mere communist propaganda, 100%. But you could find it and buy it in any paper stand and thing like this. This was not censored. And why that? Because we knew, or we were confident. We didn't know, but we were confident that we were on the right side. And we were confident that communism was not good for us and things like that. So we didn't have to care for censorship because it was natural for individuals to accept that. And you still had communists in Europe who were, in fact, who had even sympathy for the Soviet Communist Party. But we could afford to have them in our countries and to have free speech and all that, because we knew or we were confident that such an ideology would not have much success in a country, because of course these were the years where you had a constant growth and you had full employment. You had no unemployment in our countries and things like that. So this was the golden age of the in the after war period. So we knew we were again we didn't know, but we were confident that nobody really wanted to be communist in Europe at that stage. And the fact that today we need censorship is probably because we probably suspect that we claim things, we have a narrative on things, but we're not really sure that we're not confident that this is the truth. And therefore, we need to have a censorship to complement the narrative. That's how I explain it. But it's for me, it's kind of obvious that this censorship has dramatically increased in Europe, and that's very strong in France. That's very strong in Germany, probably a little bit less in smaller countries like Switzerland and Belgium, but nevertheless, it still exists. So that's again my take on this. But you're right. Basically, this polarization of society is, in my view, largely because incompetence mostly, but is largely promoted. Probably unwillingly by our government, but they do it in any case.
Before wrapping up this session, we have to emphasize that this oversimplification of the conflict, whenever you have a conflict, a political conflict within the country or outside, when we look at the conflict in Ukraine before the war started, they were just demonizing Putin, that it's all about Putin. If you remove Putin from power, that everything gonna be solved. Right now in Gaza, everything is about Hamas. Nobody talks that Hamas is Palestine. There are Palestinians have decided to just fight against oppression. And right now in the United States, the same phenomenon against Trump, but they don't think that there are many people, at least 50% of Americans voted for Donald Trump.
I totally agree with you. You're absolutely right. And it's amazing to see this extreme polarization on one individual or a couple of individuals, and we think that all the problems, in fact, could be solved by just removing Yahya Sinwar or Mr. Haniyeh in for the Hamas, and Putin on the Russian side. And that, in fact, is exactly on the line of what I said. We don't know exactly what the problem is. We just don't like Putin because he's the guy who and if you look at the history, by the way, when Putin came into power, in fact, he was at the beginning, it was quite well accepted by the West. The things changed in 2007 in Munich when Vladimir Putin made this famous speech against the US policy and NATO that tried to, let's say, expand more, but not just the geographical expansion, but also the expansion, because this 2007 speech must be understood in the light of the
We stopped the expansion of NATO.
So this is the problem is that, in fact, there are two events. We always speak about the expansion of NATO, which is one problem. But the real problem behind this is the fact that the US withdrew from the nuclear arms treaties, and especially the ABM treaty. And that, in fact, gave a new dimension to the expansion of NATO. If you still had those, and in fact, before 2002, you had a set of treaties that had been negotiated during the Cold War about nuclear weapons limitations, conventional arms limitation, and all that. All that had been, in fact, negotiated during the Cold War, even at the end of the Cold War. I'm talking about the conventional force agreement, the conventional force in Europe agreement that limits the amount of conventional force you should have and all that. So all these agreements, in fact, were a kind of a guarantee for Russia. And even if you had a geographical expansion of NATO, you had all these treaties in the background that in fact provided some kind of security. Therefore, the initial expansion of NATO just after the end of the Cold War, this initial expansion was not pleasing Russia. But at the same time, Russia didn't find it so dramatic, and they had in mind that this could be solved through diplomatic means. But as soon as the Bush administration started to withdraw from the arms limitation agreement, then the expansion of NATO took a completely different dimension. And that's the reason for this famous speech of 2007 in Munich. And from that point, Putin became the evil of Russia and so on and so forth. And that's the reason why the West from that point decided that Putin needs to be removed some way. And that's the reason why they started to support financially and politically opposition in Russia. Navalny is one example, but there are many examples of opposition movements and opposition groupings and opposition activities promoted by the West in Russia in order to destabilize the government and eventually to provoke a regime change. And the idea of the conflict with Russia, as explained by Oleksiy Arestovych, the advisor of Zelensky, as he explained on the 18th of March 2019, he explained that in order for Ukraine to enter NATO, they need to defeat Russia and to have this regime change in Russia, in fact. And so the whole rationale behind this is focused on one point, because of course Vladimir Putin started in 2007 to be vocal about NATO, but his predecessor, namely Boris Yeltsin and so on, was very compliant with the West. So no matter of discussion, I mean, he could be bought very easily if you want, and therefore he was not considered as a threat. But the problem of Vladimir Putin is that precisely he could not be bought, and he could not be bribed, if you want, and therefore he became a threat, and therefore the evil and all that. So this is the problem of the West. I mean, they focused on one person because they see this person as, in strategic term, we could say the center of gravity of the problem. And The same applies to the Hamas. Even if, and as I underlined in many times in my book, by the way, the 7th of October was not a mere Hamas attack. It was a Palestinian attack. In fact, about 20 different Palestinian movements and groups participated to that attack, and where the Hamas had some kind of, because it's a bigger group, the biggest group in Gaza, it had of course more weight. But in fact, the attack was coordinated by a council of different groups, and the whole attack was prepared by different groups as well. And but the idea of isolating, if you want, the Hamas is a way to make the problem, or to make the objective reachable. Because if you say our enemy are the Palestinians, that means you just have to eliminate every single Palestinian. If you say the enemy is the Hamas, that means that you have a limited objective, and probably it's more affordable somehow. The problem is that the West and the Israeli do not know how the whole thing works, and even with just this limited objective, they're not able to cope with it. So we are back to square one. But the personification of Hamas is this oversimplification that allows then to accept any kind let's say, measure that you take. That's the same applies to Russia, by the way. We want to well, to fight against Russia, therefore everything is allowed, including blocking bank account of Russians, or not even Russians, but people having a Russian name in France. So, you know, it goes extremely far. But that contributes to this polarization of the population, because at the end, we see that in these conflicts, and we can see even other conflicts, I mean, the conflicts with Iran or the conflicts with China, we could see that all these tensions that exist between the West, and especially the US and these countries, could be managed differently. In fact, if you study the problem carefully, you could see that it would be extremely easy to solve the problem and to make this coexistence extremely peaceful. The problem is that somehow the elites in our countries and in the US are not willing to do that. They don't want to make the effort. The enemy needs to be crushed, completely crushed. There's no possibility of negotiating or discussing or dialoguing with the enemy. It has to be destroyed, period. And that's exactly what the West tried to do in Iraq and Syria, and eventually failed, because you cannot just destroy people like this. You can obviously replace Saddam Hussein, or not even replacing him, by the way, but you can just topple him. But you, even for that, and even the case for Libya, for instance, we toppled these people that we designed or designated as terrorists, not terrorists, but as dictators. But we were not able to find an alternative. As a result, you had a chaotic situation that resulted from the situation. So we created a void. And that's exactly the problem. So we fight against, we don't know exactly what. Again, we are not able to define exactly what we are fighting against. And we try to put that under various names. Once it's human rights, otherwise, but at the same time, it's not even terrorism, because we fail also on the side of human rights and on terrorism, on everything. And so we do things, but for us it's acceptable, for the others it's not, and that's just justification for doing things. But In reality, we don't know exactly what we want to achieve. We feel that it's the way to achieving supremacy. And in the case of the United States is a little bit more transparent, has an advantage to as compared to other countries, in a sense that at least it had some kind of doctrines. I mean, for instance, the Wolfowitz doctrine, which is this doctrine that promotes or would like to promote this the U.S. supremacy in political affairs, foreign affairs, and all that, and even this kind of hegemony, and to preserve the hegemony that the U.S. had just at the end of the Cold War, this beginning of the after Cold War. So this is this aim. But to achieve this aim, it's not, we don't need to have war. You can achieve this aim by sponsoring excellence. You know, you don't have to destroy the others. You just need to be better yourself. And that's exactly the problem the West has. It has lost the capacity to be better than others. And that's for that reason, he cannot be better than he is. And therefore, he had to destroy the others. That's a little bit the problem we are facing. You know, during the Cold War, I mean, the after Second World War years, where you had this kind of golden age of the West, in fact, where you had growth everywhere, and we developed all these industrial activities that applied to United States, but also in Europe and so on. Everything was fine and all that. But towards the 80s, this supremacy started to weaken a little bit because of the price of raw material and commodities and all that. As a result, we tended to be less competitive, and we had increasingly to rely on the help and the support or the work of other countries such as China, for instance, or Africa. And therefore, a lot of activities were, in fact, outsourced to these countries. As a result, these countries started to develop, and the students started to be better than the master. And that's exactly what happened with China. And today, China produce every year more patents than the West, and especially the US. So that means that the intellectual work, the innovation work, the technological development happens in China. Therefore, China attracts the interest of other countries who are also wanting to develop themselves and to benefit from the know-how, the expertise, and the infrastructure of China. So, meaning that the West has it diminished its influence, has no longer the excellence that helped to make it success during just the after World War II period. And today, this excellence has been taken over by China and probably India at a certain point. And everything happens today in Eurasia. And this is the continent that has taken over the ability to develop technologies, high technology, and to develop extremely quickly, and not just develop these technologies, but also to distribute that technology, to make it affordable to individuals. Look at EVs, look at the high-speed trains and things like this. You know, the maglev trains, and all that happens in China. Even though the first ideas came in the West, But the West never put the resources because we were so involved in making war, and we were spending so much war, so much money in making war abroad, that we neglected the development of those technologies. But countries like Russia or China didn't spend their time making wars. They started to develop, first of all, a good educational system. They started to develop and to make such that the industrial base could also develop an educational system, so private education system. If you look at, for instance, Huawei or companies like this, they have their own academies and things like this. They train engineers and all that. So meaning that, as opposed to what the West has done, the East has built up its excellence. And today, this is the I think that's the reason why you have the success of the BRICS, because all the other countries, Africa, for instance, they understand that China has developed the capacities that are needed for the development of Africa. You know, Europeans have been, when they started to colonize Africa, they had, some countries had good intentions and they wanted to develop these countries also for, with racist prejudice, because they thought that Africa was underdeveloped and kind of subhuman type of race, and we needed to bring them to the level of humans. That's a little bit how it was at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. But by doing so, there were a couple of good things that were done: the development of railway networks, for instance, development of communication network at that time, or telephone, for instance. Things like this, which were probably good at that time, because there was this idea of improving the level of the African countries. But from the Second World War onwards, developing these countries became so expensive that, in fact, the European countries could not afford it. As a result, they didn't even maintain what they had developed, like the road networks or railways and all that. And this started to decompose a little bit. And today, typically African countries realize that if they want to develop, they need to have infrastructures, and effective infrastructures that can handle traffic for merchandise and for the trade and all that. That means for ports facilities, airport facilities, train, railroad, roads, and so on. The problem is that after World War II, when the West used to be active in Africa, they didn't develop infrastructures. They just wanted to outsource work. As a result, they developed a production plant, and they trained individuals just to work in that particular production plant. But they didn't really develop the infrastructure which is needed for the overall development of the country. The approach of the Chinese today is precisely, and that's the idea of the Belt and Road Initiative, is precisely to develop an infrastructure. So the Chinese are ready to invest in development, an infrastructure that then will help to develop other activities such as trade and things like this, even to outsource production, because with the development in China, the cost of labor in China is raising. So that means that at a certain point, China will have to outsource work in some other countries where the standard of living is a little bit lower. So The Chinese have already that in mind. As a result, they come in Africa with an idea of development that is in tune with what the new authorities in Africa are looking for. And that's exactly what's happening, for instance, in the Sahel region with the Niger and Mali and Burkina Faso countries who have expelled the French and the Americans, by the way, out of their countries, because they realize that their future is related to Asia and no longer to Europe. And they started to have contact with Russia and China to have their support in developing infrastructure, to develop production of agricultural products, for instance, and things like this. So it's not just that as of today, these African countries are no longer countries that where you have an outsourced work from Europe, but they start to develop their own economy based on the development of their own, for instance, agriculture. I've seen recently, I think it's Burkina Faso, they started to have the help of the Chinese to develop a production plant for tomatoes. The production of tomatoes-based product. So this is local production, and you need, because today, I mean, Burkina Faso is one of the big producers of tomatoes, but it imports tomato paste, for instance. So it's kind of strange because they had to import a product that in fact they can produce themselves. So they said, stop with importing that. We will produce it ourselves. We just need the help to have the facilities to do this, and the Chinese will do that. So that's the kind of development model that the Africans are looking for. And for that reason, the ingenuity of countries like Russia and China, who are not looking for immediate profit. They will benefit from this relationship, but not just next year or over next year, but in the long run, they will benefit from it. And they are planning for the long run, not just for the short term. And that's this kind of approach makes the success of this country. The thing is that the Europeans and the West could have done that, but the problem is this didn't come to our idea. It didn't come to our mind to do that, because again, we are still considered the rest of the world as a factory, and we have the ideas, they produce and we buy cheap, and that's it. And that was the fundamental of the so-called globalization in the 90s and early 2000s. Basically, you produce and we benefit from it. That was the idea. So therefore, we lost our excellence capabilities, and the Asian countries have understood that. Now they have the excellence, they share this excellence, they train people, they invite people to develop themselves, and they are not trying to achieve immediate results. They see their result in the long run, and therefore that suits exactly what the rest of the world is expecting today. So the West has totally lost this view. We still think that we are a model of excellence, but we are no longer. Our societies are not happy, and we see that on every election. We see that our societies are unbalanced. We see that more and more, especially in the US, where people, the rich people get richer and the poorest people get poorer. And there is almost nothing in between. So, and that starts to happen in Europe as well. You have more and more millionaires and more people who cannot afford to eat for the whole month. So there's something wrong in that. Instead of having a middle class that develops and basically a middle class based society, we tend to destroy the middle class and to have the lowest and the up highest class to develop those two, in fact, at the expense of the middle class. And you have exactly the opposite happening in China and other countries, who in these countries they try to develop a middle class. It didn't exist so far, so it's probably easier to create one. But in the foreseeable future, definitely the Asia is today, in my view, the model for this excellence that the West is claiming but has in fact lost. So that's a little bit my view on that.